And while he yet talked with them, behold, the messenger came down unto him and said, Behold, this evil is of the Lord. What should I wait for the Lord any longer? Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. I'm your host, Scott, joined today by Pat.
Hey.
And Jason.
Hey.
And we've made it to the second book of Kings already in this Holy Bible book club series. So my question to all of you at home and the two of you, how do you think the relationship between Israelites and their God has changed throughout the years, from the time of Moses to the time of Elisha? How do you think the people of the Promised Land perceived their God? How do you think that has changed, and how do you think it has stayed the same? Let's start with you, Pat.
Well, that quote directly goes into the beginning of chapter 7 when Elisha mentions, when she mentions eating the food of the Lord, and she says, Behold, you will see it with your own eyes, but you will not eat of it. So it was similar to a promise to what Moses said to the Israelites, or in a way,
Or God's promise to Moses, in a way.
Or God's promise to Moses, yeah. So I would say it was essentially the same thing. Just lots of idolatry going on and just breaking different nodes within God's network and seeing which one works and what doesn't. And then Elisha comes along and says, Well, don't you know that if you follow the Lord, you will get your own piece of bread? And this is what happens when you break these laws, and you will not be able to taste it, essentially. So I thought of it as just the same repetition over and over again, just in different patterns.
That's interesting. I saw a lot of like the whole trust breaking down. Like, you could say God's promise to Moses is like, you know, all of the people that you're leading into the Promised Land are going to receive this gift, but you're not. And then Moses saying, well, it's worth it either way. If I can help my people, then I'll do it. I'll trust in the Lord, trust in this promise, and I'll do whatever I can do to fulfill that. But in like the time of the kings and before that, and the judges, were like, everyone did what they saw was right in their own eyes. And in Kings, it's like no one trusts that promise anymore. Like, even though they've all made it to the Promised Land and they've acquired what their ancestors have fought so hard to get to, but at the same time, they're just taking it all for granted and just, you know, it doesn't really matter. All of this good stuff comes from God, but, you know, all the bad stuff comes from Him too. So what am I going to do? What am I going to do with that? What do you think,
yeah,
Jason?
It's like what's right next, or something like that. Anyway, sorry, Jason. Go ahead.
No, you're right, Scott. They're essentially getting punished. And back in the time of Moses, they got punished too for falling off the way. And back then, I think the relationship Moses had with God was more like a younger child. Just have this new relationship building, even though like all the Abrahamic traditions are behind it. This story, Kings 2, there's a lot of different layers going on here, and it's written by that Deuteronomic redactor who, you can tell by the way that the story is put together. It starts with, you know, one of the prophets essentially handing over his spirit to another prophet. Their names are very similar. Elijah is the older one, and Elisha is the newer one. So the book has some of Elisha's miracles. And then there's like a long list kind of in the middle of all the different kings. And basically it reiterated how how they would do evil. The majority of the kings would do evil.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a continuation of the story of David and into First Kings and Judges. And we have a point that's really historically important because Israel's broken into two sections. You have the northern state of Israel, those tribes, and then you have the southern state of Judah. And each is failing on their own. But I think as we've come to where we're at now in the story, I mentioned that Moses was more like a younger kid. I think God kind of expected people to not worship these idols. That seems like a thing that's really pissing God off. So he's punishing them, kind of like adolescents. That's how I see them, like an adolescence, a 17-year-old's relationship with 30-year-old, 40-year-old some parents.
It honestly, in so many ways of this book, it reminded me of, you know, exactly what's going on today with the whole rise of the nuns, they call them, or the unaffiliated, or maybe more specifically, the anti-theist. Because, like, in the same way that, you know, in the Israelites' view or the Judites' view, no other religion is good. Like, it's all bad. All these other cultures and societies and beliefs have to be done away with because we have the right answer. And I'm like, that sounds a lot like a lot of the anti-theists on YouTube trying to debunk all these ideas of gods and spiritual powers. And, you know, like we talked about before, the Bible says pi is 3, so it's not the word of God.
There was one really interesting thing in the end of this book. I think it was chapter 18 of the 25 chapters, so kind of near the end. But it mentioned Moses by name, and it said that they had Moses had this whole time this bronze snake that they worshipped as an idol. I think its name, if I can pronounce it correctly, Nehushtan.
Yeah.
And I think one of the later kings who was somewhat okay, Jehoram, don't quote me. There was a lot of strange names in this story. But it says that he eventually destroyed this idol.
Yeah, I think it was there was a character in this book that I talked about in one of the earlier parts of this little series. It was either First Kings or one of the books of Samuel, where it predicts Josiah coming forth and, like, smashing the altar and getting rid of all of these idols. And then in this book, we have Josiah come back and, or, like, the prediction gets fulfilled, and he's pretty much presented as, like, the only redeemable, like, good guy in this story. Like, him and one of his followers recover the book of the law from Moses, and he says, well, we gotta go back to the old ways and all of this. But as soon as he's gone, they go right back to the old ways, and God still punishes him because they didn't do a good enough job.
We have to go back to the island, so to speak.
It's kind of a reoccurring theme. I mean, there's going to be the one person who's, like, flawless. Maybe it's Samson, or it was Noah back long a time ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are other characters like that in the Bible that we've read about, too.
The New Testament has a character I could think of. No spoilers yet,
though.
Oh,
yeah. It's foretold, yeah. But, yeah, it's only one person, so it's like the 1%, right? And I think they use that to justify why it's kind of a self-substantiating claim that theirs is the one religion amongst the many that's true. And that motif of that one character that's flawless is just kind of a hologram of that idea.
Yeah, but, like, you could say the same thing about, like, only worshiping a single god. Like, one god in our, like, whole sphere is going to be a lot more easier to deal with and contend with than a whole pantheon, because then you're like, every time I do something, it's going to please one god and then displease another. So narrowing it all down to one god is almost like a psychotechnology of like ultimate focus. Just focus on the one god, and then that's like focusing on your one single outcome, like your one future that you want. It just, it gives you some focus, and it protects you from combinatorial explosion and cognitive dissonance, where everything just comes flooding in. You have 700 things you need to do, and you can only do one at a time. But when you're having just one god to worship, it's like, okay, I know what I need to do. I have the focus. Everything is ready. And the one thing that's keeping me from worshiping this god fully, to the best extent, is all these other religions. So let's get rid of those guys.
In a way, you can say that those gods are different versions of yourself.
Yeah.
And the one true god is the better version of yourself.
Yeah.
Ooh, I like that one.
I kind of like had that line of thinking with the, when we were reading Nietzsche a little bit. Cause he like talks about how like a human being is just a collection of these different urges and desires and wills that like all come down to power. It all comes down to power in the end, but like you're still completely divided among the things that you want out of life. And then he just kind of puts Dionysus at the top of the hierarchy because he has to. Like, there's just no other way around it. Like, even when all of these other paganistic religions, there's always one god at the top, whether it's Dagon or Baal or Baal-Zebub, who cares? Like, they always have one chief, like Zeus, and then the rest are underneath them.
Yeah.
So maybe, I don't know, no Christian would agree with me, but maybe it makes more sense to have a hierarchy of gods than to have just one where you're kind of narrowly stuck in one path. And if you adhere to many different gods, you can take kind of multiple lessons in multiple ways from multiple circumstances to say, you know, maybe Yahweh's lessons are good in this situation, but who knows, maybe Zeus and Ares and Hera have other things to teach me in other situations.
Yeah, with this religion, it's kind of on or off. You're either Christian or you're a heathen.
Well, it's not Christian.
Right, at this point, it's...
yeah.
What do they call
there's
it?
There's no name for it.
Asimov calls it Yahvism, after the god Yahweh.
Well, to kind of touch on what you were talking about a minute ago, Scott, I think the reason we might have this is, I'll try to stumble my way through this, but like Jordan Peterson would talk about how we have a hierarchy because biologically we came out of a hierarchical system. And so it actually feels good to know your place and to be undivided and just have that focus on one thing. So that may be one reason why this religion kind of came about. In this specific story of 2 Kings, I don't know if you guys caught all of the magical stuff going on with
the
prophets. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, and I find myself drawn towards that when I'm for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Like his mentor, the older one, Elijah, was taken away from the earth in a similar way that we've seen before in Genesis with Enoch.
Yeah,
you know, just one little one or two sentences in Genesis. A lot's going on there. Enoch goes and walks with God, and here with Elijah, he is, it doesn't sound as peaceful as Enoch because it says like a chariot of fire and horses of fire come in and strike him, I believe.
Yeah, he was abducted by aliens.
And yeah, he went to Providence or heaven in a whirlwind. So it sounded like it was chaotic.
Yeah, but like it doesn't really give you any specifics in the Enoch section. It's just like God took him and then he walked with God. So like, you know, there could have just as easily been another whirlwind and chariot of fire or a UFO that came and grabbed him up. But like we just don't have that details. But here maybe we get a little bit of a better look into the situation of what they perceived as happening. Maybe not what actually happened. Maybe he got struck by lightning and they just said he was such a great man that now he's with the Lord. And then later on the conceptualization of heaven grew out of that articulation kind of thing.
Like a group of people up there.
Yeah.
Because I mean, in the religion as they have it, Yahwehism, they have angels of the Lord, and we'll see that later in this chapter. So there's already kind of a communion or a hierarchy up there.
Yeah, and like in the Islamic tradition, God created the angels and the jinn and the humans. So like in multiple traditions, there's kind of more of a hierarchy in place to say that God is at the top of it, and then everything else spiritual are these angels, and then there's the jinn, who are like higher on the scale than humans because they're more like corporeal or whatever, but like they also have their own religions themselves. Like when you look at the Islamic tradition, jinns themselves can be Christians or Muslim or atheist or whatever. It's pretty crazy stuff. So like I really wonder how much there is to that, and if the jinn or something related to that was ever part of the Jewish or Christian tradition, and what they really mean by like going up or walking with the Lord and all of these weird little idioms that keep popping up.
Yeah, I always stumble when I try to find the interface between going up to heaven and actually like walking outside and looking up and thinking in space, up is not up. Like what's up above my head is actually like jutting out horizontally to the equator of the earth. Yeah. And if I was in...
You almost have to redefine the word up, because it doesn't mean just up there. It's... It's like a spiritual up there. It's not like among the clouds. It's among the clouds inside your own psyche kind of thing. That's how I always think about it.
I could kind of relate to it as like a DMT level up.
Mm-hmm.
It's up, but it's also everywhere.
Yeah, like I haven't done DMT, but I've had like some kind of a psychedelic experience where like it feels that you're in a rocket ship going straight up, but you know, you're just sitting there. Like all I did was take an edible and sit down on my couch, but now all of a sudden I'm flying through space. So like there's up, but it's not the directional up. Yeah. What are some of the other little magical bits that you found? Because that one's just bait for the ancient astronaut theorists. It's hard for me to think about that because it's all I can think about these days are ancient aliens.
The beginning of 2 Kings kind of goes over like these good acts. Chapter 4 has like 44 some verses on it, but at one point in chapter 2. Right after he had asked Elijah for a double portion of his spirit as like a kind of parting gift. I'm not sure what the significance of that is, because every translation I read through used the word spirit. There wasn't any other translation for that. But he purified the water of a town. And then there's a famous passage or verse here that atheists and people love to reference, where he like summons two bears. You remember that part?
Oh yeah, how could I forget, like, Jason?
like it says there's a couple kids jeering at him, right? And
Yes.
then he summons two bears, which apparently are possessed by the spirit or angel of the Lord, and it mauls something like 42 kids.
Yeah, 42 children just wiped out by two she bears. The
And
kids were saying, "Go up, you bald head, go up," which
we're
is
like,
another weird representation of that language, because that's what he was reacting to. Go up, you bald head. Well, here's 42 bears. How do you like that?
two
Yeah,
bears.
two
It's two
bears on the
bears.
42 kids. Sorry.
But like, I don't believe that all 42 kids were jeering at him. I bet it was like two hooligans in the crowd.
Yeah. Like
And it, that's kind of represented.
it really makes you think what go up really means, 'cause you compare those two like representations of that language, and it's like, are these kids telling Elisha to go die? Are they telling him to go get, struck by lightning? Or are they saying,
Walk off a cliff.
go walk off a cliff, or you're better off with our Lord? Because it could just as easily be translated as that with our limited understanding of it.
Sure.
It's really strange.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a microscopic story of what happens in the macroscopic story of Kings, because you have, let's say, my theory that there's two or three hooligans amongst these 42 kids. So you got a couple that are doing the wrong thing, and maybe the majority are minding their own business. It only takes, a few hooligans in the crowd to like
Yeah.
ruin the group as a whole. And I think that's what we see happen, even though later on in the book it's talking about the kings, how they failed, and there was probably a majority of other people failing too. So I'm not sure if it translates or translates exactly.
Yeah, it's a good representation of, your sins and your like horrible actions are going to affect those who you associate with too. Like those one or two kids that said, "You stupid prophet, I'll get you." That those two kids got 42 children mauled by bears. You could look at it that way too. Like they got all of their friends mauled.
I heard this really interesting quote. So the kids that get mauled, we're assuming they end up in heaven, right?
Well, that's if you believe in heaven, but I haven't seen a single representation of heaven yet in the Old Testament, so
So we don't know what happens to them.
they're going to Sheol as far as I can tell, which is translated as a pit in the ground. So
Oh, wow. The quote I heard was, any sin can be forgiven, but sins still have consequences. So I was imagining if these kids did end up in heaven, that the God would, forgive them, but the consequences, you no longer get to be on earth.
but now it's kind of like a, sin by omission. Like if you're the kid that can do something about, the other kids not getting bullied anymore, you choose not to, maybe that's the sin they're getting punished for.
Good stuff. There were a couple other magical things where he helps a poor widow repay some debt using
Oh yeah,
olive oil
like
magic.
all she has is like a pot of oil or something, or a pot of olive
She's got
oil.
like half a pot of olive oil, maybe, which is a very valuable thing.
Yeah. And he says
And
like just pour it off into like 20 other basins and you'll never run
keep
out.
pouring.
Yeah. Just
If you stop pouring, it'll stop.
as many cups as you have, just keep going, keep going. Then you can sell that and then you'll be better off.
And that kind of ties into the like let's wait and see what happens attitude that you were referencing at the beginning. You have to have they're calling for continual faith. Can't stop pouring for a second. You have to have that faith until you run out of pot. And that's when it stopped.
So what's the running out of pots symbolize in that metaphor then?
I think it just symbolizes that you have to have some kind of realistic limitation. Like you couldn't fill an infinite number of pots. Maybe just a representation of life itself. Like we're all gonna one day die. We have a limited number of years. And everything on earth is like that. They talk about it in Buddhism, impermanence. So yeah. I think it's just a limitation.
Maybe it's like there's only so many people you can reach kind of metaphor. Like you can try to help as many people as you can, just keep pouring. But, you know, not every one of those pots are going to be susceptible to the olive oil. You're not going to be able to help everybody, but the least you can do is keep trying. Like some
people,
what was that? Sorry.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say it's a really miraculous story because they're creating something from nothing kind of situation, creating an abundance of olive oil. We have, I guess, Elisha using the spirit of God or something to make this happen and interfering with the free market.
Oh, yeah.
The next story, he helps a old woman have a kid, and that's like a running motif we've seen.
Yeah.
The old lady can't conceive, and the Spirit of the Lord intervenes. But then the son apparently has some kind of emergency headache, like encephalitis or something, and he ends up dying. And then Elisha resurrects him.
Yeah. A lot of people coming back from the dead in the Bible.
And it was a real strange situation, too. Like, he stretched his body over the boy.
Yeah, he's like, I don't know. It's like, I struggle to find, like, a rationalist explanation of this one. Because it's like, you could say, well, he's giving him all his body heat. He was in a coma, and then he started performing CPR. He's like, his arms were on his arms, like his face was on his face, and then he breathed life into him, something like that. It's like, okay, you could kind of say that's CPR, but doesn't it also say he's been dead for a minute? Like a good
while? Yeah, he'd probably been dead for like at least an hour, so.
Yeah, and like the same kind of like analogy pops up in the New Testament too with Lazarus and of course Jesus, where like they were dead for 3 days, the both of them, I think, before coming back to life.
There was one other miracle here, and I don't know if the chapter was titled this in the Bible you're reading, but I thought this was the most hardcore, like, death metal title ever. Is called Death in the Pot. And it was a story, yes. Like, let's see, this is chapter 4, verses 38 to 44, where the people are gathering food and vines, gourds, and one of them remarks that they didn't know what this particular gourd was they were cooking with. And he said that there was death in the pot when they were eating it. And then Elisha threw some flour in and made it edible. But I think they were going through some famine at this time, some serious famine. So they were eating foods they weren't familiar with. And it kind of part of the story, I think you touched on it, Pat, at the beginning, how Elisha was able to use a small amount of food to feed like 100 people. Like it was some bread. I don't know if they just eight little bits or if he somehow multiplied it like bread magic.
Yeah, it was mostly just flour.
I think the chapter in my Bible is called like the poisonous pottage or something like that. It's just like,
okay.
Yeah, I think it was kind of like it could just as easily be he cleaned the pot out. You know, maybe they were using it to mix up, like you said, unfamiliar foods. Put some bad berries in there, some whack mushrooms, and all of a sudden everyone was getting sick and dying from you know, foods they thought were safe, and they said, "Hey, Elisha, we need your help. This pod is killing people. Our food is killing people." So I was like, "Well, you need to eat better food. Here, have some
gluten."
Yeah, gluten's bad.
No, they're eating these mushrooms, and they're like hallucinating all of these miracles they've seen. But I think the blasphemy I just said should be stricken from the record. These chapter four is talking about, you know, there's a poor widow. She doesn't have enough olive oil. There are these people who are scourging food that they're not familiar with because there's a lack of food, and there's a famine. And I kind of got the message with kind of how we opened was that there's a famine in this region because the people have been following other gods, so they were being punished.
Yeah.
And then I think the next two chapters or something, like army commander gets cured of leprosy. But then,
yeah, I like that
siege.
I like that little bit with the Syrian captain Naaman. I took some notes for this guy. He's like, he comes to Elisha from Syria and says, "I've tried everything to get rid of this leprosy. The only thing I haven't tried yet is your God Yahweh. So, you know, give me something to work with here." And Elisha just says, "All you got to do is go down to that river right over there, wash yourself 7 times, and then skedaddle on your way. You're good to go." He says, "Well, I've done that already. The river where I'm from is a lot better than this one. What are you talking about?" He's like, "Do you want to get healed or not? Because this is all I can really do for you. This is all I'm offering." He says, "Well, okay, I guess I'll do it." And then miraculously he's cured of leprosy, and he says, "Well, now I need a piece of your dirt to take home with me, because Yahweh is the only God that I can worship now." And that was another part that Asimov talks a lot about too, with the henotheistic beliefs of the region, where it was kind of accepted that these gods only have power on, like, in their own country. So the God of Israel wouldn't be able to do anything in Syria. So he takes like a couple jars of dirt and he goes home, and he pours that dirt, so he has a piece of Israel with him where he can pray to Yahweh.
Kind of like a vampire power story, like blood magic. I think that's what vampires use. They have to take some of the dirt from their ancestral grounds with them.
Yeah. But like the next part of that story, where Naaman, the Syrian captain, is going home, and Elisha's student says, "Hey, what'd you charge that guy for curing his leprosy?" He's like, "Nothing. I just let him go home." He's like, "Well, that's no good." And then he goes after him. He says, "You know, we need some payment after all. So I'll take this, this, and this." And then when he gets back to Elisha, he says, "Look at all these goods I got from him. He didn't even realize he had so much to pay. He was a captain after all." And then he says, "Well, that's just unacceptable. You know that leprosy I just cured of that guy? It's yours now, for you and all of your seed. All of your children are going to be lepers because of this sin."
That was metal.
Yeah, we're really lucky to have, like, you know, modern medicine and antibiotics, because a lot of people in this time period have leprosy, it seems like.
Yeah.
By the way, going back to the serpent on the stick conversation that you brought up, Jason, that's the same symbol we have now.
Yeah, for the medical.
So.
Yeah.
Fun little fact.
We talked a little bit about that when we were going through the Torah, because he used like the staff, like the bronze snake, to chase away the other snakes and like saves everybody. And then he used it to cure people. So people just took the legend of the golden snake and started worshiping a stick instead of the actual God that made all of that possible. Like, I think what it's really trying to, like, get home is God doesn't work through these idols. He works through the methods in which Moses laid out for you. You follow the laws, you'll be fine. You follow this bronze stick, you're not going to get anywhere. you need a code, not a statue.
I mean, he's kind of telling him not to rely on superstitions. But if you saw all the things that happened, like with Elisha's miracles, or like after a bit, there's a part of the middle of Kings, chapter 7 through 16, there's a long list of kings and their failings. And then around chapter 17, Assyria lays siege on Israel. And they eventually... were taken into exile by the Assyrians, and Sumerians settled in their land. So now they have foreigners settling in. And it says that the Samaritans didn't follow the law of the Lord, and yeah, so was, God sent lions.
It was, yeah, the Babylonians, because it was the entire Assyrian Empire, which the Babylonians were a part of. So they were like, hey, we conquered this land, so you can move into Samaria if you'd like. They got some grapes and olives.
So. But if you were these people that just settled and then all these lions appeared out of nowhere, apparently by God, would you not be superstitious and more likely to rely on like idols and other superstitious artifacts?
Yeah, it's easy to say that. No, I'd be an atheist back then, but that's just not an option, really, at that point in time. It's like, I can call myself an atheist because I learned about, you know, secularity and the separation of church and state and everything about that from other atheists spreading their own religion, so to speak. But there was nobody saying there's no gods back in that day. Like, the henotheistic belief was the standard. It's just like, there wasn't an option of saying, no, there are no other spiritual powers. It's that these spiritual powers outweigh the other spiritual powers.
Yeah, and you go outside at night on a, let's say it's a stormy night and you see lightning, you're going to most likely, like me, I think of like spiritual things. When I see like grand or, you know, vistas and things that are just beautiful, I think it's just our nature to look at things and see some kind of divinity there, even if it's not there.
Yeah.
It's like seeing a face in a cloud. We see something.
And the problem is like when people say that that's not rational, because here's a couple examples. Like, they put lightning rods on churches because they realized that lightning was striking churches more than any other building. They thought it was God being angry, when in reality it was just because they made churches the highest building. So when they perceived, you know, lightning striking at the church more than any other building, they said, okay, we just made God angry. We need to overcorrect a little bit. And then when they were deciding to design the lightning rods and where to put them, well, put the lightning rod on the church. That's where God throws his lightning. That's how he gets angry. That's how he shows us his anger, is he strikes the church with lightning and burns them down. So let's just protect our churches. And now when lightning strikes, we'll see it as a sign instead of chaos and destruction. And I had another one in my head. I forget it now.
Chapter 19 of this story, we see another angel of the Lord, where they are is it the southern kingdom at this point? Judah is now fighting the Assyrian. It's one of the two, the north or the south. And the angel of the Lord kills 185,000.
Yeah, Judah.
Of these soldiers.
Judah is fighting the Assyrians, and I think it mentions that the only reason that God let them survive is for David's sake. I'm like, yeah, that tracks. The God of jealousy playing favorites again makes sense. I'm sorry.
Classic angry Yahweh. And then at the end of this book, it's kind of tragic. You know, it says 10,000 of the Israelites are taken into Babylonian captivity. It kind of wraps it up. Like,
yeah, they're just,
we
they're
had
just
all these gone. Kings.
They're just
they
gone.
Failed. You lost your land of milk and honey.
Yeah.
You're like either exiled in back into Egypt or into Babylon.
Yeah. And this is what gets commonly referred to as the 10 lost tribes of Israel. It's like Benjamin has already been kind of wiped out previously. Judah's still alive, but the rest of them, they have no identity anymore. They just get assimilated in the surrounding lands. So, like, the Israelite land doesn't really have any meaning from this point forward. Like, it's just focused on Judah, the Judites. And another thing is, in my version of this Bible, at least, this is the first mention of the word Jew to describe the Jewish people. It comes up twice in this book, and it says, like, yeah, it just refers to them as Jews for the first time. I thought that was kind of interesting.
I'm not sure where this story is going to get picked up, because I think the next two chapters, the Chronicles, like, go all the way back to Genesis.
Yeah, it's more of like a recap, as far as I know.
This is like the season finale, and then Chronicles is kind of like, this is what you missed.
Yeah, it's like when all those YouTubers say, like, watch this before the next season of The Mandalorian comes out.
And they always say, make sure to subscribe. Obscene.
There's another part, chapter one, I think, that I wanted to talk a little bit about. It mentions the famous name Beelzebub. Or Baalzebub, or Beelzebub, or Baalzebul, or Beelzebul. It has about 800 different pronunciations, but it all means the same thing.
King of Second Kings? Or which one?
This was Second Kings, chapter 1. It was when one of the kings, I forget the name, he gets sick, and he says, "No, go to this other land of Ekron, the god of Ekron. Go to them, and, you know, I need to be cured from this sickness." And the translation that we have, the most popular translation of Baalzebub, is Lord of the Flies. But there's a lot of evidence saying that that name was just kind of, like, changed and sullied to sound a little bit different when his actual title was Beelzebul, which is like God or Lord of the heavenly house or heavenly mansion. That's kind of what it translates as. So in the Bible, it makes it look like this, like, either like fly or disease oriented deity that's like worshiped in strange lands is just realistically another representation of a chief deity from another religion. So all of these other definitions that you have of Beelzebub from, you know, Binsfeld and these other, you know, middle age writers and philosophers and witch hunters and whatever, like calling Beelzebub the Duke of Hell or a Lord of Hell or one of the three of the triumvirate of Hell, it doesn't track at all. And I'm getting really disappointed with every name that I thought was like some mythical demon from Diablo is just, oh no, it's just the Zeus of the other religion that the Israelites are interacting with in a land called Ekron. Same with like Belial isn't referring to a deity at all. It's just, if you are a son of Belial, that means you're a son of bad opinion or an idiot, or you're just wrong, or you're worshiping the wrong thing. You want to be the wrong thing. But like, Beelzebul could mean really anything, but yeah, as far as I can tell in my research, it's just another one of those gods. And another thing that Asimov talks about, Dr. Isaac Asimov, is that there's a Moabite stone or a Moabite steel that gets referenced in this book somewhere. And I'm trying to remember. I think I have it written down. But there's
a steel?
Yeah, it's like a big stone or a tablet. And it's
okay. It may have been in chapter 3. They were talking about fighting the Moabites, and yeah, the king sacrificed his firstborn son.
Yeah, so overall, this book, to me, based on how I read it, it's just a book of lore with different kings and their flaws and how they've ruled their own kingdoms and everything. But yeah, it was interesting. But it was interesting to hear more like different sides of this book.
Yeah, I agree. I would say a continuation of Judges and the First King. I mean, I think it was always meant to be one long story, First Kings and Second, but the way it was edited together, it was just broken into two.
Yeah, Kings, the two books of Kings and the two books of Samuel was originally one text. And then, like, the Deuteronomic editors or authors afterwards kind of divided it up just to make it look a little bit better. And in the Catholic Bible, it's listed as 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Kings. They cut the Samuel name out of it altogether. But yeah, the Moabite stone thing was referring to the bit in chapter 3 where, like, the Israelites are fighting the Moabites, the Judites get involved somehow, and then there's just like a, it ends with the Moabite king like sacrificing his child to like signify that, you know, the Moabite religion is still going, it's hasn't been taken out at all. And there's like an artifact that we've discovered called the Moabite stone that basically references that biblical account. Like, it all lines up. Like, it talks about the battling against the Assyrians and against the Israelites and the Judites, and it talks about their god Chemosh in the exact same way that the Israelites would refer to their god Yahweh. Like, it's literally the same. Like, Israel, like, the God of Israel came into our land, and then Chemosh drove him out. Like, it's like a depiction of a battle of the gods, like, driving each other out of their own lands. And they, like, talk about it in the same way that's, like, I don't think the Judaistic or Israelite religion was at all very different from any of the surrounding areas at this time, at least. Like, the Judites, you could say, like, with all the stuff from David and Josiah, they may have salvaged a little bit of what kept their identity. But as for the rest of them, I don't really think there was much of a difference. Like, they all believed in, maybe not believed, but they all acknowledged the existence of, like, Chemosh, Melkart, Baal-Zebub, Yahweh, El, whoever, because that's just the way it was. It's like every country in the land today has a flag. You wouldn't say, no, I don't believe in their flags. I don't think their flags are real. It's a symbol. It's real. It's a part of reality in the way that everybody perceived it. Like, Yahweh for these people and Chemosh were about as real as the American and Canadian flags. That's the way I would describe it.
Yeah, it's a good description. They're ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe we've read through all of these books of the Bible. It's pretty surreal. It's
taken us a few months.
Yeah, it's a trip.
We're looking forward to Job, I think. Yeah. Coming up in a couple.
Chronicles is next. We'll have to slug through those.
Five more books, and then we'll get to Job.
Okay. We have the Odyssey coming up from Homer. That should be our next video. Gonna have to finish that book.
Totally different writing style.
Yeah. Like,
well, I guess it depends on what translation you get.
We'll save this, most of it, for the actual recording for the Odyssey, but there were so many similarities and so many like stark complete opposite differences. Like I don't know how to articulate it, but it's almost like the more I get into it, the more I think that Homer was a woman.
Oh, you got me interested in learning more about that. I guess we'll have to stick around and wait for that discussion.
Yeah, let's just throw that out there. And as a little teaser, as a little cliffhanger for the next video. But yeah, do we have anything else to mention for 2 Kings before we move on?
No, I'm pretty much done.
Yeah.
I'll leave it with this quote, not from the Bible, but just a quote I heard over the last couple days. There is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.
Well, remember to like, comment, subscribe, share with all your friends and family. Check us out on our website, bookwave.club, anchor.fm, YouTube, everywhere you can find us. Until next time, may the force be with you.
And if you're a book lover, that's the way. Bookwave.com. .club.
It's not .com, it's .club. Jeez, get it right.
No, it will be soon, though.
One love.